Hey everybody, welcome back to 10% True. Just before you get stuck into this episode, I wanted to let you know that in 2024, I'm going to be republishing my book, Red Eagles, America's Secret MiGs. That's the story of the 4477th Test and Evaluation Squadron and the program Constant Peg that exposed American fighter air crew to secretly acquired and operated MiGs in the Nevada desert in the 1970s and 1980s. The book's been out of print for a while. It goes for crazy prices online, but I'll be republishing as a softback exclusively through my website, 10percenttrue.com. If you're thinking about supporting the channel, you'd like to buy the book for yourself or even as a gift, please do go and place a pre-order. I'll put a link in the description. All pre-orders are going to be 25% off, and I'll make sure I personally inscribe and sign your copy for you. Anyway, I'll let you get back on with enjoying this episode. Take care. JP, welcome to 10% True. Thanks for being a guest on the channel.
Nice to be here. Thanks very much.
So JP, I've interviewed probably about 40 or 50 guests, mostly fast jet aircrew at this point on the channel. And some of them have been fairly well known in terms of their names and their occupations, test pilots, famous pilots, that kind of thing. But for most people who are interested in military, aerospace and defense, who are my age, which is, let's say, mid to late 40s, not wishing to age either of us, yours is the face that would probably be most familiar of all of my guests. And that's because back in 1991, January, we probably saw you on television with your head bowed, bruised, and being paraded in front of the cameras by the Iraqi regime. And of course, you and John Nichols were shot down in your Tornado on one of the strike missions that you flew, I think your first strike mission. So the purpose of today's interview is obviously going to be to talk about that experience and talk about being in captivity, the things that happened to you afterwards, and whether or not or how your experience changed your life. But before we get into that, I'd really like to understand a little bit about who you are. How did you get into the flying game, and what was your route into the RAF?
Well, most of the pilots you talked to thus far are good fighter pilots, because by definition I'm a bad one, because I have more takeoffs and landings. So that's notoriety is not the best thing to have as a pilot when you join, because anybody, I am absolutely bog standard fighter pilot. All my friends, whether they became squadron commanders, Red Arrow pilots, whether they're American, British, French, Swedish, whatever, everyone's the same. I never wanted to be anything other than a pilot. I don't know why. In my family, I had no military background. Other than like my generation, a lot of my grandfather, my uncles had been to war. And I had no real flying in my family either. But I can never remember ever wanting to be anything other than a fighter pilot. And so it's like wanting to be a doctor or a journalist or a teacher or a scientist. You're very lucky as a child to have that level of vocation in your life, because it does drive you. You know what you have to do, and your focus is about doing that. And so that's what I went. I went through school. I went to a grammar school which had a combined cadet force. I did test in advance at 16. Those who did quite well back in the day got a flying scholarship. So I got a flying scholarship. So I had my flying license just when I was about 17 and a quarter. I didn't learn to drive until I was 20. I also had my gliding license. And then I did more tests and got a university cadetship. And I was sponsored by the RAF through university. So I was one of the lucky ones, because that just doesn't occur nowadays. That level of investment, you know, to be sponsored through university just doesn't occur. So I'm the generation that the youth hates, because we bought houses cheap and we got sponsored through university.
And you have a pension that's worth something.
Yeah, I have a pension. Thank you. Now, just everyone's now going to hate me, go beat him up, because yeah, I'm that generation.
What did you make of fast jets then when you got to them? Because the curious thing I always think about flying is that it sounds like a stupid thing to say, but it looks so different from the outside than it is from the inside. You know, you can be at an air show and see this noisy, smoky aeroplane go by making incredible sounds, and it looks amazing. And then you get in the aeroplane and you fly, and it's actually a very different experience. So did Fast Jets live up to, I mean, I'm guessing you went Jet Provost and then Hawk.
Yes.
Did that experience live up to what you had in your mind told yourself it would be?
Well, I haven't flown since 17. I flew the Bulldog, then I flew, the Jet Provost, which was okay. I enjoyed the Jet Provost because it's a jet and it makes lots of noise. But when you got to Hawk, you went, wow, this aircraft, it was like a little sporty jet, and you thought, I'll never be able to fly it because it was, people don't see, they think that people are pushing the stick like this, and it's really fine movements because you've got so much air going over. The aircraft, you know, covers 500 feet this way, 500. Well, that's obviously, I'm a bad pilot. No, everyone does that, where you go, how do I, will I ever be able to fly that? It's finesse and touch. And then after you fly the Hawk and get taught how to fly, you get used to the speed. but the real thing that when you do TAC weapons and you do things like air combat for the first time, which is where two Hawks outward turn for combat go, you turn away from each other for 1 minute, which puts you about 15 miles split, inward turn for combat go, and you basically play chicken. And the closure speed is what? 1200 knots, so that's about 1500 miles an hour. And you don't want to give any displacement, distance off or angle off, which is basically the person can outturn you. So you literally, well, the rules say, I think if I remember back on, it's 30 years ago, not within 200 feet. But we're talking, just like you see on Top Gun, a dot when suddenly straight behind you, whack into 7G. Flying fast jets is better than you see in the movies. Being, you know, and you have all these evolutions where you go, first time you go solo, first time you do low level, then the first time you do formation, the first time you drop weapons, the first time you do air combat, the first time you're actually do the full tactical scenario, because after a while you're not thinking about flying, you're thinking about beating the other person and escaping and fighting the aircraft. It is so complex. It is so absorbing, but the adrenaline is just amazing. And I say this respectfully to anybody who's been a passenger. Yes, you feel the G of 7G or what have you, and you see them turning and burning and you get the sense of it. You do not get that absolute. I mean, if they photograph the head in heat, your brain is just buzzing with all the thoughts of absorbing and making the decisions constantly. It's just love it. It's better, better, better than you think it is going to be when you're a 12-year-old little boy or girl.
So did you have
look, I'm 61. I haven't flown for 20 years. Loved it.
I was going to ask that. Well, I was going to ask it at the end, but let's ask it now then. So that sounds like it would be a difficult drug to replace then. What have you done for 20 years then to substitute?
Yes, you cannot carry on flying. Well, you could do. I could have stayed in, but I would have, if I had stayed in, I would have followed a career path. But it's like everything, it does normalize. It does normalize. I lost a lot of friends in my time. And you join as a young person in the mess where it's only about you and only about flying. By the time I was 38, you go, I'm married with kids and it's no longer just about you. And I know it sounds silly. You grow up. You can't, you know. You, and that's not to say that you're not grown up as a pilot. What I'm saying is, your life is so much more than flying because you have children and you're trying to do the best for them. And when you've got 38 and you've been flying for such a long time, you've done everything. You've flown to the States. Yeah, I've got the war stat. I've done, you know, you had done night formation, close formation at night in cloud. You'd had your emergencies. You'd lost. You have done everything. So in many respects, it's like anything in life. When you start repeating it for the second, third or fourth time, it's not as exciting. Then also, when you go to these places at 38, you're not included. you're included, but not quite the same with all the 25-year-old pilots who are, you know, absolutely buzzing because you're now a 37, 8-year-old married man who doesn't just go to the bar as a single guy. You're a married guy with kids. So basically, it's just, it's not a bad thing. It life evolves. And since when I get the buzz, I decided to foolishly start my own business, which is scary as hell. I decided I'd been on such a conventional, I went, so God, grammar school, university, British forces. I'm not denying, this was my reason why I left. I'm not denying the forces are a brilliant career. But you go, I was really good at jumping hoops. And it's very along a tube. And I thought I could stay until 55 and, yes, end up at a reasonable rank and have traveled the world stimulating people. But where's that self-definition, that self-determination where rather than waiting for someone to pat me on the head to give me permission for the next rank or the next role, I'm just compliant to wherever they send me. And I'm not denying it's stunning and interesting, but I'd like my own self-determination and actually along this tube, maybe just take a left or right turn and see where it goes. And so I thought, can I survive off my own wit? Not under, I had a couple of consultancies, very big consultancies, very big names. I would have earned a reasonable amount of money who were offering me jobs because I did an MBA and all that sort of stuff in my early 30s. But I thought, I don't want another corporate sheep pit because the RAF is a corporate, really. Can I actually self-determine my own provenance? And much of that, I think, did come from the Gulf because it gives you, you know, when you're sat in a cell with no choice, you're naked and they're going to kill you, even a cup of water is not your choice. You want to indulge. When you have choice, use it. And that's where, since I've got back, this is where I find, I try and explain to people, please don't think I'm a damaged human being. Do you know how much confidence does when all that choice is taken away? You suddenly realize that actually you can still choose who you are and how you want to die, even in that last moment. And that was a pivotal moment in my life. And that gives you a confidence, which is a gift in reality.
So your decision then was to become a motivational speaker? Is that what you
mean? No. I mean, I know it sounds silly. When I go to an Air Force reunion, that's the marvelous way people can dismiss me. Oh, are you still doing the motivational speech? Which nicely kind of goes, yes, you know, puts me back in the box. And I, you know, it was just straight luck. You got shot down. We all went to war. You got shot down. Yeah, okay. You do the motivational speech. Yes, I cannot deny I was given a story on a plate. You know, it wasn't 7 years of being a prisoner of war in Vietnam, which is far more challenging. And really, you know, these guys absolutely need to be upheld. It's more you go suddenly, unexpectedly, Kuwait got invaded. You know, virtually 2 months later, the Air Force was going off to, you know, to surround Kuwait. The lead up to war, you go to war. We got shot down, got the prisoner of war, then you return and we were famous for 2 years. You know, that is a story, that whole evolution of that time of my life is a, yeah, it makes me sound conceited and self-absorbed. It that evolution over such a short period of time gives you a whole load of a story that people want to hear. So I get that people concentrate on the backstory. But actually, I'm not a traditionalist. I'm quite a progressive. I may have joined a conventional system. I may be a middle-aged white bloke of a certain age, grammar school, you know, you could say conventionally, but I'm a progressive in the way I think. I'm very much future focused. And why would I want to be fixed 32 years ago? You know, that's just boring. I'm very much wanted to engage and see what I could do in the future. So, I'm very much, that's why I started the business. Can I explore? What have I learned in life that I can help other people progress in their own ways. I'm very fortunate. I followed Nelson Mandela on stage in South Africa. I just dropped that in, as you do. And he said a very wise thing. He said, he said, I wouldn't recommend the methodology, but he said he learned lots in his 27 years. And actually, I would agree with that premise.
Let's get back then, John, because we will cover this in detail. And I've got questions around that, as you would expect. But let's get back then to your sort of early 20s then, because did you want to go to Tornado? Was Tornado your first choice? Did you want to fly with somebody in the back seat?
I think any fighter pilot, you just want to be a fighter pilot. That's what you want to do. What I found through flying training is I was quite surprised. I was pretty good at school. I was pretty good at sport. I pick up stuff quite fast. I found myself challenged through flying training. It's quite sequential thinking in learning to become one. I'm not a sequential thinker. So I found it quite challenging. Certainly in basic flying training, I probably almost got lots of flex flight, which means, they could chop you. I had quite a lot of that. I lacked self-confidence when I went through flying training, but survived. So I survived basic flying training. I was okay in Hawk. I was okay moving forward from there. So I just wanted to fly fast jets. So I think quite rapidly. I wasn't a person who said I need, back in the day, you had the real single seat aircraft, which are Harrier, Jaguar and Lightning. God, we had one guy who went Lightning. You had some of those guys who were very deliberately, I want single seat. I just wanted a cockpit, to be honest. And so the two-seat environment, I did go all the way through. I at TAC Weapons, I did okay, I think. And then you get the selection. And I said to the Air Force, anything but Buccaneer. Again, I don't see the point of flying old aircraft. Forgive the Buccaneer people. I'm not bitter. You probably did the right thing. You probably saved my life. But I got sent Buccaneer and I did about 65 hours on Buccaneer and got chopped. But I thought they'd done it wrongly, so I fought hard. And so normally it takes 10 years to get back to fighters. I was back within 22 months. So they sent me, I became an instructor pilot on Dominies. I did 800 hours, single pilot captain on Dominies, which is a business jet. Teaching navigators, that's where I first met John Nicol. He was a student. I was an instructor pilot there. Did that and then got sent to Tornadoes. So had it not been for that delay, I wouldn't have been in the Gulf because my friends who went straight Tornadoes, they'd finished their tour and had been posted back as instructor pilots. And I was quite a new Tornado pilot by the time the Gulf War was on. So that is my background. But yeah, quite interesting. I suppose if you take the mindset with the pilot stuff. Helen said, the moment my wife Helen said, the moment you got sent Buccaneer, I knew you were gonna, you were so deflated. You just lost your fight. I was numb, just completely empty. When you go, really? The last thing I wanted to was fly Buccaneer over the sea. So was it lack of talent or lack of fight that made me get chopped? I don't know. Arguably, having been an instructor pilot since, if they saw something that you say, it's very easy to kill yourself in fast jets. So, of course, no one likes that, having to fail something. But in reality, yeah, I wanted Tornado, and I ended up on Tornado, which I loved flying that aircraft.
This might sound like a strange question, but I think it's probably relevant to your later experiences then in the Gulf. But you have this passion for flying. From a young boy, you wanted to be a fighter pilot. You start flying fighters. Is there a point at which, and again, I hope this doesn't sound like a stupid question, but is there a point at which you sort of start thinking about the application of what you're doing to warfare? I mean, I know you're going around and you're dropping bombs and you're trying to shoot each other down, but it's peacetime. You're flying over the UK, you're flying over Germany. There's this Cold War scenario. Nobody thinks it'll ever happen. Did you at any point think, well, actually, you know, yeah, I will likely at some point in my career end up in combat and I need to start mentally preparing for the fact I may have to go and kill people. I may end up being killed myself as a result of enemy fire rather than because of a flying accident or whatever. Is there a moment at which the sort of dots are connected between what you're doing because it's a passion and you just are infatuated with it and you have been since a kid, and the reality that this is an extension of a foreign policy or a country's ability to implement foreign policy, and you may have to go out and do this for real?
Yes, of course there is. And this is a relatively long answer. Okay, first of all, I was a very naive 16, 17-year-old by experience more than intelligence, I think. You know, just like many, I lived in a market town. I didn't have very much life experience. However, when you decide to join the military, the military does exactly what it says on the tin. And they do know that in the army, the first question they ever ask in the interview is, can you kill someone to order? So it doesn't matter what age you're going to go, can you kill someone to order? In the Air Force, and I knew this at 17, and, well, you could say, have you already fallen off the moral abyss by being able to say yes to that first question? But then you say the Air Force, back in the day, it was height of the Cold War, you say, can you drop a nuclear bomb to political order? So, yes, I'm naive and green as any 16, 17-year-old, desperately wanted to be a fighter pilot. I walked out onto, this was a local cricket pitch. I sat there for 3 hours trying to balance this question because it's an impossible question. You know, you've got the desire that you want to do this job, but you've got to somehow justify something that is almost unjustifiable. And it was very much the mad policy, mutual assured destruction. I sat there going, can I not? The way of joining the two sides is, at the time there were between 40 and 70,000 nuclear warheads in the European front alone. So my moral sort of skip around that real difficult question is, if it ever got to the stage, mine would make no difference, which is moral abdication. For the way I am, could I, you know, if you're under threat and, you know, if I was in an army and you're alongside me and there's people running forward trying to kill me, could I shoot that person make sure you die? Yeah, that's, I think, for my moral framework, a relatively easy answer. Very different when you say you do that and 30,000 people or more die. Big, big, big difference to my moral framework. So I've probably lost 50% of your audience already because you say, you know, I'm a baby killer or whatever they want to say. But you go, so that was my moral application in some regards. And here I was a nuclear trained pilot. So I joined the Air Force and in Tornado I was trained, and my target was a SAM-5 site in East Germany, which is a long-range missile site that takes out our high-value assets. I won't bore you what that means. I did an interview when I was in my early 40s with the BBC. They took me out. They wanted a Cold War pilot, so they pulled me. Nothing to do with the Gulf. They wanted a Cold War pilot. And they took me out to the site I was meant to hit, which was about a kilometre long and about half a kilometre wide of concrete revetments. I mean, this thing was huge. You'd need 100 missions, if not more, on conventional weapons, and you probably wouldn't even make a dent on it, whereas a small nuclear, tactical nuclear weapon would remove the site. And it was very much a military site, a missile site in the middle of nowhere. I remember then they were asking me this same question. I said, here I am, I'm about 40. I've been fully, you know, immersed in the military, brainwashed, if you want to use that word, or into, accepting whatever. Can I drop a nuclear bomb? I don't know. There's questions in life that are just too huge to contemplate until you're actually in that moment. You're unintelligent, you haven't thought around all these things, but you get to that moment where you go, you do. It's a moral abdication because there's a gap between thinking and the reality of doing. And in that moment of what is right and wrong. And here I did a speech recently to some university air students. And they're at university. I said, so I left my university air squadron 40 years ago. I'm at the end of my career. You're at the beginning. And why we need ethical, moral military leaders? It's because here I am. So I was asked in my very first officer defense studies, a Royal Green Jackets major stood up and said, do you think Russia is going to drop a nuclear bomb on us? And at the height of court, everyone goes, that sort of direct question. You go, I suppose so, because that's what you all get told. And in our side, we get our own version of it. And he went straight, he said, and it took ages for people going, I don't really, because you do. And he said, I don't think so, because history has proved net Russia's never been outside its borders. Interesting moot point here. And I said, here I am, 40 years later. So you're at the beginning of your career. I am at the twilight of mine. And whilst you think I'm a boomer and you're a zoomer, and we have these differences of uncertainties, who here thinks Putin will drop a nuclear bomb? And then you go, and if he did, what would you do if it was your decision? Because it's very easy for the 20-somethings to look at our age group, say, well, you've just made a mistake. Say, put yourself in our position. 20 years, because 20 years goes like this. In 20 years' time, you'll be that decision maker. What would you do? Because it's not just about Russia. It's about balance of power globally with tectonic plates with China, Russia, all that sort of stuff. And what you do and don't do and what they... And you just go, what would your answer be? How would you answer that, Steve? It's a rhetorical question, yeah. Really, because it's an... But would you accept it's an impossible answer question to answer, really, unless you're in that moment?
I think that the whole idea of it, as you described earlier with MAD, is that it will never happen.
But it's abhorrent, and I never I never expected when I joined the military ever to go to war, because I thought the Russians or the Soviet bloc weren't stupid enough, and I didn't think we were stupid enough to actually go to war. So I joined the military never expecting to go to war.
So in that case, then, as an extension of that, when you were going through survival, escape, resistance, evasion, training, the RAF equivalent of SERI, were you also looking at that as a sort of a gaming experience rather than, I really need to sit and absorb this stuff because one day I might use it?
No, you do immerse yourself in the reality, and the military is very good in that. It's in the scenarios, the contingency planning, the acquiring knowledge, they make it as real as possible to make sure that you understand it is for real. And you do gain skills, and you do apply those skills, because I have applied those skills in reality. There are things that work, there were things that don't work, there were things that were dated because it's all, you only train for the last war in reality. So, you immerse yourself in the reality and try and apply it for real. But I'm saying behind that, did I ever really expect to go to war? No, because when I joined, and in the 80s, war was, certainly when you're on Tornado, which was the nuclear capability aircraft, is war was the end of the world.
Hmm. So there was a a conventional mission for you, wasn't there? But that was the same sort of scenario, wasn't it? It was the sort of fold a gap, East Germany comes across Russia comes across the border of East Germany, but no tactical nuclear weapons are used. It's conventional munitions. Is that correct?
How all these wars were, right, in exercises we had something called Tacoval. So, and it's basically to test the station, and you've got 5,000 people on station, and with the four squadrons to test the state, its war readiness. So it was all taken very seriously. So about 2 weeks before an exercise, you'd get exercise on signals, because you get signals coming through anyway of real stuff coming through, of intelligence, all that sort of stuff, because it is, military, it has to be absolutely up with the latest level of intelligence to be able to negate threats and predict threats. And you'd have exercise, and you get, terrorists have taken over the Moldavian embassy in Mogadishu, for the sake of argument. I don't know why those two countries came up, but accept the premise. You know, and then you get another thing and another thing. And it's basically to show that these things don't happen out of the blue. It's sort of an evolution of events. It's almost like Sarajevo and the First World War and non-linear dynamics working out that ends up in the First World War. So you get all these, the scenario that builds, so you're getting excised, that you go. So 2 weeks prior is to sort of say, and then you'd get, the Russians have just done this. Well, Warsaw Pact have just done this, or they're building, they're doing an excise, but the newspapers say excise, just like Putin did prior to invading Ukraine. So that's where it's frightening when this whole recent stuff in Ukraine started, is because it virtually followed the playbook that we've been working on for 30 years. You know, I've been out of the military for 20 years, 25 years. And it virtually followed that playbook. Small incidents, small justifications to then movement of shooter to an exercise into, oh my God, he's now invading. Mm. And then the evolution of the evolution was the looking at the Soviet bloc at the time had so many tanks that they would overrun us, and you get past a point where they used a tactical nuclear weapon. We responded, and you have tactical nuclear exchange to them, then into full Armageddon. And that was the evolution of the Tacoval scenario. But interesting enough, when we launched, we had the end of an exercise, the 5-day exercise. Families used to watch all the tornadoes take off, 75, 80 of them, all radio silent, all just... all 80 of us all going off to fly east and drop our alleged nukes, practice, obviously no nukes on board, but just to practice the launch. Do you know, then the end of the exercise was called, everyone returned, went to the bar. We never did a single practice after, we didn't practice war after the launch. Mm-hmm. No, because, well, I was in two German bases, those would have been charcoal.
Yeah.
You know, I think that shows you that how the world thought. We never practiced anything after the nuclear launch.
So what was the impact then of learning about Hussein's invasion of Kuwait in August of 1990? And then, was it Labrook or Gütersloh? You were 15 squadron, weren't you?
We were at Labrook.
Labrook.
And yes, suddenly news that Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait, and virtually within a day or so, it was you're going to war. I mean, I was recalled. We were on a flight in Germany, and it was kayak formation return on guard, kayak formation return to base, kayak formation return to base. Now, on guard, that was the recall for nuclear Armageddon. And you went, shit. Now, you're intelligent enough to go, well, there's been nothing. You know, things don't just happen like that. So there's been none of this lead up of anything at all. Oh, my God. Flew back, put the jets on the ground, wandered in the squadron. Flight commander says, Kuwait's been invaded. We're going to war tomorrow. Shit. And that was suddenly the whole pace of life. Now, we didn't. It was a couple of months before the squadron left. But you go, suddenly you go, where the hell's Kuwait? Mm-hmm. None of it, you know, where was Kuwait? Who knew where Kuwait was before the first Gulf War? So and then you said, we don't have any maps of Kuwait. We had no maps. So we literally, we had a colour photocopy. We multi-paged colour photocopied the Times Atlas, big enough to make a wall diagram to have a map of Kuwait.
Wow.
And then slowly but surely, all the signals started coming in, where they were, what they were, that was then put all the the army units and the missile sites, and you build the intelligence pictures. We waited for the maps to come through, which is quite interesting. When you fly in the desert, they come through. They all look like sandpaper. You know, the jets get painted pink. I mean, all those sorts as you start to evolve to go to war.
As part of your, I mean, I'm asking leading questions, but as part of your, as part of this experience, then, are you now starting to think a bit more about things like escape and evasion, the possibility of being shot down? Are you frightened? And how do you deal with those things that are then going through your mind? Or are you just compartmentalizing, you're just doing the job?
A mix of all of it. You're not frightened, actually. It's almost like, however distasteful in some ways it may sound, everyone was fighting to be involved. It's like being in the biggest project in your company. You don't want to be in the sideline, you know, or it's the scoop story in the newspaper. You don't want to be doing, you know, births and deaths when your mate's doing the biggest story in history, you know. So that's no different in the military. Everyone's training, suddenly so many of the rules are removed. And literally, you know, we went from our rules back then were not below 250 feet, not above 450 knots overland in the UK, and for no formation bigger than four aircraft. We got to a stage where we were cleared down to 50 feet above ground level at full war speeds. So that's 600 knots plus in up to 8 to 10 aircraft, 12 aircraft over the whole of the UK. And interesting enough, because there was a sense in the public, there wasn't a single noise complaint.
Wow.
Fascinating. So we were literally flying at treetop levels. And sorry, a fully laden Tornado, because we were flying in warfare, because you have to get used to the weight. You know, you're. Well, 30 tons doing 600 knots at 50 feet above you. You know, not a single noise complaint. You're suddenly going over ranges to do electronic warfare. How does the aircraft work to negate missiles? You really do, although you've learned all this stuff, you actually do go, you start going, I want to know more about that missile system. You know, what color is the plume? How do I act? What's this? You become far more definitive in how you're doing it for real. And you go from, I was on 15, 20 hours a month, you're up to 45 to 60 hours a month. You're suddenly doing, right, oh, air-to-air refueling. Now, Germany squadrons didn't do air-to-air refueling because our targets were within range. Suddenly, right, that was it. You know, that was the thing, right? You know, Kuwait's been invaded. We're going to air-to-air refuel to Kuwait. We'd never air-to-air refueled before. Right, doesn't matter. We got a brief in half an hour's time. After the brief, you get airborne. If you get in the basket, you're qualified air-to-air refueling. We're going to air-to-air refuel to go to Kuwait to go to war tomorrow. Shit. And so that is the pace of life doubles, trebles. It's consuming. It's overwhelmingly exciting. It's very real. Yes, you get the briefs on Siri, but or conduct after capture, but we've all done that. Most aircrew have done that already, and you reaffirm what you're going to do, and you work out, and there's a whole load of tactics and strategies that we're meant to follow. But we weren't going there to lose. You know how very rapidly, and when we went out there, if you see American power. In reality, they have more aircraft on one air base than we have in our entire air force. It is overwhelming American power. So we weren't going there to expecting to lose.
Can you talk a little? This is a bit of a sort of a rabbit hole, which I try not to go down. But I'm curious because I'm interested in your thoughts on it. But if I remember correctly, it was Pablo Mason was the squadron boss.
No, Pablo Mason was a formation leader, my formation leader.
Okay, all
The
right.
squadron boss was John Broadbent, and then he led one formation. We had three formations, one led by Gordon Buckley, one led by John Broadbent, and one led by Pablo Mason.
Okay. I was curious to understand what the squadron leadership was like then at that point. I mean, as I said, it's not the main story. It's not the main purpose of this conversation, but I'm, you know, I'm curious to know how you felt the leadership was and what your experience of it was.
What they found out when immediately after the Gulf was initiated and we needed to send a squadron, they sent out the most experienced guys. So all four ship leads and qualified weapons instructors, QIs, which are the highest ranking on a squadron in terms of skill level, pilot level. And they sent a squadron of those out. Funny enough, they found that didn't work very well because you send a whole bunch of chiefs and they all argue with each other and they don't work together. So funny enough, squadrons work. So there was one of the comments where you said we literally had sent a generation of all our weaponeers, which are QIs, out to the Gulf. And I think one famous comment was an air marshal, I don't know who said it, said, that is our entire corporate knowledge of how to apply air power. Best you bring them back and send out some cannon fodder. I think that was the comment. And do I find that offensive? No, he's bang on right. Wars don't last forever. And you could have wasted that level of knowledge in the Air Force. So I don't have a problem with that. So they sent cannon fodder because in two styles. So how a squadron works out, you'd have the squadron commander, you have two flight commanders, and and we'd have another senior squadron leader, and yet we had four ships, so 12 aircraft in total, three four-ship made of constituted crews. And normally on a squadron, you'd have the four-ship leads who can lead any size formation. You have pairs leads who lead another aircraft, and then you have and others. Though most people can lead all of them, but you're given those qualifications as you get more experienced. And so they sent out de facto squadrons as they were designed, exactly that way, where you had the leadership of the squadron, which tends to be a squadron commander and two flight commanders, all of whom flew on their squadrons, you know, or flew their formations. And that's how we fought the war. And you have the four-ship leads who lead the four ships, you have the pairs who lead each pair down, and you have the other people who are, you know, who are in each pair. So, and that worked extremely well. And our squadron, I think everyone would say this, we were very blessed. Our squadron worked extremely well from my perspective. As you develop the tactics, suddenly what used to be the tactics, well, we'll go through, do this, that, the other. What happens when you go to war? You go, hang around. We're not going to do that because you go through, they haven't woken up. The second guy goes through, they've all woken up and got their guns out. And by the time I go through, I'm getting shot to shit. You know, let's not do that. Because suddenly, but everyone's opened those conversations. It's really, you know, the tactics that you've flown and used, you go, is this real? You know, because now this is proper real. They're firing real guns and real missiles. And how do we negate that threat? So it very much was an evolution. They give you weapons you haven't flown before. They suddenly gave us things like 2250 liter tanks, which are big tanks, which means you can do the range to fly the distances. Normally that hadn't been through the test pilots, but they just gave us big tanks. Say, get a couple of experienced pilots to fly them, see whether they work. If they work, you can clear it with them. Wow. So you get, there was a whole load of stuff where the usual protocols didn't have time to change them. And they say, make a sensible decision, determine your own tactics. We had to do close formation at night. Squadrons did different methodologies. We had no formation lights to do close formation at night. Our squadron decided to do line astern, which was off the glow of the engine. So we were 5 feet down, 5 feet back or so. You could feel the engine wash on the fin, which means you're right down. But we did it on the glow of the engines, which were just there at night, sometimes going through cloud. And the leader said if they went below 80% on power, the glow would disappear. And you go, you're doing 400 knots or what have you in close formation. You basically, that's what you're paid to do in the military. There's no perfect answer. Now the rules are removed and you've allowed to determine your own risk profile. You've been trained to make those judgments in risk and you determine what's sensible and what's not sensible. And basically your brief is win. And that is... one, unbelievably exciting and engaging and intelligent, but also at the same time, you'd be surprised how everyone going, we were allowed to go down to, We normally, military works on 10 to the minus 3, so easiest argument, 1 in 10,000 chance, by dropping a bomb, the bomb will frag you. So that's 10 to the minus 3. We are allowed to go down to 10 to the minus 2, so a 1 in 1,000 chance that you're going to crash into each other, or the bomb will frag your own aircraft, because a piece of something will do that. Our squadron determined, look, war's dangerous enough, why make it more risky? So we stayed at 10 to the minus 3. But you're allowed to make all those decisions yourself. And so I hope what I'm trying to convey, you have intelligent people having an intelligent debate to best effect the risk they're going to engage in a professional sense.
So this is as good a time as any, then, just to talk about the low-level tactic as an alternative to a medium-altitude tactic. Whatever, what can you describe what the rationale then for the RAF going in low-level? And it wasn't just the RAF. If you look at the first night of Desert Storm, Strike Eagles went in low-level, and the Navy, US Navy went in low-level. Everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people went in low-level. The only people who really didn't were the 117s, and they had the low observability in their favor. But the Air Force was quicker, the US Air Force was quicker to transition to a medium altitude profile, dive toss and that kind of stuff. The RAF stayed with low level for a little longer. I mean, that's a separate conversation, and, you know, sort of tacticians can argue about that forever. But I'm just curious to know what the conversations were in the squadron then about that low level profile and going to the 10 to the minus 3 risk factor you talked about. Whether that was part of it, part of the conversation, whether or not there was actually even an option for a medium altitude delivery for you guys against the targets you're going to be going up against. What were the conversations?
It's more a contextual argument, wraps it all up in many respects. Right. Air forces, how do you take out a country? Iraq had the most integrated air defense system outside of the Central European front, which means it has overlapping systems with the ability if some goes down, etc. So how do you take that out? And if I'm going to attack you, sat in your room there, you say, but you're in a concrete bunker, you know, 1,000 miles in the center of Iraq, and you have a ring of steel around you directly, short range, plus medium range, plus long range missiles from the border onwards. You have long range radars, everything. You're really pretty bloody secure. It's almost impossible to take you out. Aha. But where you say the classic phrase, war is deception, which is all around Sandhurst, if you go, war is deception. Air power is confusion. You're really good when you're very bright, you've been selected, you're well-trained, you've got unbelievable weapon systems. And if you looked at it from outside, it's impossible. But what air power does is peel the onion back. So I want to decrease your decision right down that you have very little idea what's happening. So we go from take out long range radar, so you have less time to make a decision. So this is all about the timeline. From long range radar, I'll do it this way. Long range radar, you have less time to make a decision. Then we take out long range missile systems, then medium range missile systems to short range. So you've basically decreased your ability to make a decision from an hour or so down to minutes. You then send in drones. So the moment you send in a drone, we send in drones, which have the same radar signature. You switch on all those radar systems you've kept secret from your missile system. You switch it off. We have an electronic intelligence aircraft that can pinpoint where they are and send missiles down that. So then you start going, we're getting attacked. Because if I switch my radar on, people will shoot at me and kill me. So you start doing procedural switch on, switch off, where you go, switch on the radar, have a quick look, turn it off, change the frequency, wait a couple of seconds, switch. So you're already down to 50% of your decision. This goes on and on. We jam your frequencies. We have chaff and flare. We change formations. We get down to a level whereby a flight of a missile is 40 seconds. You've got 40 seconds to acquire me, or else I put 8 tornadoes over the top of you. Each have 8 1,000-pound bombs. So I'm putting 64 1,000-pound bombs, which have a frag zone of 3,000 feet, on top of you. in under about 2 minutes 20. But that's only 5 minute slot of 24 hours where you get Mirage, everything like that. Now, in determining that, if we sent everyone in the same way, same day, you would still be able to use those missile systems. So what we do is we have to do 360 degrees. You don't know where we're coming from. 24 hours, day or night, and you're limited by night because most of your systems are visually done, not just radar. And at the time, to send in the biggest threat, and you start this campaign on missiles, which require radar, because they're far more effective. So if we send in everyone at medium level, the missiles are the huge threat, and guns are not a threat. So we fly, guns are a threat up to 16,000 feet. Why? Because the bullets go up, and then bullets come back down to Earth. So you fly above about 16,000 feet. So then the only threat is missiles. However, we don't have enough assets to protect medium-level aircraft. The Americans do. So we go in across all heights, all aspects, 360 degrees, and low level is below the radar horizon. So they can't just go there coming in medium level, high level, cruise missiles, B-52s, Mirage. I'm doing this deliberately. You say this is an overwhelming, confusing, where the hell are they coming from? What are they doing? And we're going in at low level. And then we were going to throw the bombs and the missiles onto the target. There was an agreement. There was never going to be a low-level sortie during the day because you get handheld missiles and they can see you. We went in at midnight, expected to plan and go the following morning. We came in at midnight and said we were going to do a low-level day sortie on the first day of the war. And we argued for 3 hours going, that is ridiculous. We've mitigated, that risk profile is too high. We've agreed. And they said, no, we've mitigated the risk. It's a dispersed operating base. We argued for 3 hours. We lost the argument. If you can't take a joke, you shouldn't have joined. We went to war. We got shot down because it was a bad decision to send a tornado. Hell with the fact we got grief. You say you do not send a £25 million and, more importantly, two highly qualified aircrew on a day low-level mission against airfield by changing your mind at the last minute. We got shot down. There was only one day low-level sortie by a tornado against a target. There were lots of night low-level missions, but then it got to a stage, having taken out the radar systems and removed the missile threat, the major threat then became the gunfire. So everyone popped up after about a week to fly above the bullets because we'd removed that threat. So it's all wrapped up in how you dismantle a country, where the major threat is, high or low. And as you say, everyone went in low, medium, or high. The Americans went to medium level soon enough because they have the assets to protect their packages. The British do not have those aircraft. So we had to wait a little bit longer to allow that risk to decrease that we could then go up and self-support ourselves at medium level. You know, people think we're paid to fly pointy jets. We're not paid to fly pointy jets. I am paid to disrupt, destroy, or dismantle the air power of another country to prevent their air assets attacking our troops or removing our air power. And that means going into interdiction, air interdiction, which is flying behind the battlefields to take out high-value assets to prevent doing that. So it is highly intellectualized, highly intelligent in people who've thought this through. There's almost air traffic control for each of these, and the way we apply our weapons in what way and how we attack. That, not me. This was determining you have to go and learn all this shit. So I'm paid to beat you. I'm not paid to fly an airplane. I'm paid to outthink the very intelligent people on the other side who have a different political view to us.
I think the way that it's normally described, though, is in much simpler terms and not bringing in all the different layers of the onion. So typically what you hear as a criticism of the RAF going in low level in the first couple of well, I don't know if it was the first 2 weeks or I don't know when they made the transition.
It was about the first week, and then we
first week. So it was that they were slow to respond to the fact that the low-level threat was higher than the medium altitude threat. That's the criticism that you hear, and it is put in those simplistic terms. Sometimes it's even the case that people say, well, they should never even on the first day or the first night have flown low-level because that threat was more substantial than going in and dropping a bomb from medium altitude. That's sometimes what I hear as well. So,
yes, maybe. I mean, the thing was, we had JP233, which was the runway denial weapon, which had, what, about, I can't remember the figures, 30 runway denial things came out and about 200 per casing of minelets, which we're going to use in Germany to cut up runways, so prevent the Soviet bloc using runways to attack us. Which was a hell of a beast when you put it on the aircraft. I mean, you know, a ton of weapons or what have you, huge, or 2 tons or whatever it was, huge, great big wardrobes on the bottom of the aircraft. They worked in the soil base of Europe in the fact that with the clay muddy soil, it created heave. It was meant to create heave, the great big slabs of the runway going up. When you put it in the desert, it blew a big hole in the thing, but because it's sand underneath, it just dispersed and it just had a hole in the runway, which made very little difference. The guys who flew it at night, and there were about 2 to 3 sorties that happened over the first week, they all came back terrified because you have to fly straight and level. I won't say how long you have to fly for. There were 2 sticks, a long stick and a short stick. We decided to use the short stick, as everyone did, because no one's going to fly straight and level for that long over the most heavily defended targets on the planet, which are airfields. But you've got to fly straight and level over an airfield. And everyone just said it was just, you went from pitch black in the desert for 2.5 hours to 2.5 minutes of the most abject terror, with your aircraft completely illuminated with all the gunfire, everything, to then straight back into pitch black as you flew home, saying, and you go, yeah. So some of it was, it's like all wars, you start off with what you have and try and apply it, and you learn pretty fast. And, you know, when aircrew are going up, we're not doing that again. That's bloody stupid. Funny enough, you end up not doing it again.
Tell me a little bit about your target then, JP. You've already said it was a dispersed site, it was an airfield, but what was it? What was the... I mean, do you even do like a risk assessment? Or do you just say, here are the threats that are protecting it and we need to devise some tactics with the QI to go and hit it?
No, of course you do a risk assessment, but that is military, everything in military. God, officer training is crisis training. Every military course is about risk and crisis management. It's not called as such, but effectively it is. Are you a person who can deal with in the pissing rain carrying a concrete block for no apparent reason? Yes, look, well done. You can go beyond yourself. You know, can you do this? Well, is it dangerous? Well, how dangerous? Make a judgment call. You know, I mean, that is military training through and through. We're not known for our creativity, let's say. Yes, the whole thing is, what are the risks? What, you know, and you look at the defenses. You've got a whole load of standard operating risks that you cover as well, which I won't cover, but it's to do with missiles, all sorts of things like that on both sides and defenses in and out. So it's all those sorts of things that you determine the levels of risks. And a whole load of what ifs, which are pretty standard when you fly military aircraft. You know, here are, what if my radio got shot to shit? Well, how do I get back without getting shot by my own people? I won't answer those questions for you. But there's a whole load of questions like that where, you know, what if this happens? Okay, what if, I mean, that are, you've learned over the years of training, because those were learned and taught throughout the Cold War, because people have thought about all those sorts of things. The biggest thing is identification, friend or foe, is effectively the answer overall. How do we know that you're an enemy or blue forces, red forces, effectively. That has always been the challenge. When you if you fly out that way, how do you come back this way? And that's the complexity. So you do all the risk, and then you go on the immediate risk. You've got the general where the armies are, so you plan a route to avoid all the armies or what have you, and avoid the least, to create the least risk. So you work out to the target, but you also work back from the target. What is the target? What are their defenses there? How are they likely to defend their thing? What are we going to expect? So how you work, you work to and from the target with two different mindsets, and you work out the risks the whole way.
And so your target was an airfield, wasn't it? Well,
yes, we were attacking Aramala Southwest, which is to the southeast of Baghdad, which is a dispersed operating base. So it wasn't a main operating base is where they have aircraft, but a dispersed operating base is one that's probably 10, 20 miles away, which you're going to use once we've, if the first base is taken out. So in terms of shock and awe, what you do is, basically, you want to take out all the pieces of concrete that ever existed that the Iraqis couldn't fly their aircraft.
Did you feel ready? And I don't just mean ready as in that mission and the planning that went into it, but ready as a person, as a man.
Yeah. We were very well trained. We had been out of the desert for a month and a half. No, extremely well trained, actually. Very ready, operationally minded. No, pretty confident, to be honest. Not overly so. When you started at the beginning, I had my moment of real realization on the night of a mission. We'd just updated all the plans, or the morning of the mission, just updated all the plans and walked off to breakfast. There was a marquee where there was breakfast. And just walking out, it was only 50 meters to the tent. I just kind of stopped and went, and carried on walking. And that was a realization. This is real. This is here. This is war. And but your only concern is to make sure you do everything right and not let anybody else down and make sure you do your job right. But then the moment you start into the role where you go out to the aircraft, take all the pins off the aircraft to do all the things, it is a trained response. And that doesn't mean you become an immoral robot. What you're saying is a trained response. You know, A bolus V bar C, it is flying. It's no different to what you've done every day of your career to date. A sequence of events, to do the takeoff, everything is a sequence of events. And the only time it ever gets different, really, is actually the only time it got different to normal training was coming off target when we were getting shot at. Up until then, we hadn't been shot at. You know, we went in, we lofted, which is a number of miles out from target. Well, you go up, we have flown over lots of bases, both out in the desert and in Europe, where you fly up and you do a loft attack and and you come back and you've got other aircraft who try and attack you. I've done that hundreds of times in my career. So you go, it is no different to training. The difference is when we started getting shot at, when we started coming back, well, that was very different. The other guys will have flown out. Yes, there's a perception it's real and it's war, but they flew back. They weren't shot at.
Thanks for tuning in to 10% True. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Feel free to subscribe, and if you're on YouTube, hit the bell button to make sure you get notified of the next episode. Thanks and take care.